You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1400 in Manila, 10 a.m. in Tbilisi, 7 a.m. here in London and 2000 in Honolulu. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
This is not conjecture. This is the grim reality facing millions of people in El Fasher in North Darfur.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations warns of impending large-scale massacre in the Sudanese humanitarian hub. We'll examine what's happening on the ground and the international response. Then quadrilateral defence talks between the USA, Australia, Japan and the Philippines begin tomorrow. How will China react as the group pushes for collective capacity in the Indo-Pacific? Both the European Union and Russia have plans for expansion. Where does that leave the Eastern European and Western Balkan nations waiting for EU membership and at risk from being enveloped by a new Iron Curtain? That could be a reality for the citizens of Georgia who fear Russification under a new foreign agents bill. We'll hear from Tbilisi as police use violence to break up demonstrations of tens of thousands of people who rallied in opposition to the law. We'll have a roundup of business news and a rustle through the papers. Plus,
the residents need to feel like they're being visited and not invaded.
We'll learn how Mallorca plans to encourage tourists to holiday responsibly. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The United Nations has warned that an Israeli assault on Rafah in the Gaza Strip is on the immediate horizon. China launched sea trials for the Fujian, its third and most advanced aircraft carrier, according to state media today. And New York City police raided Columbia University last night, arresting dozens of pro-Palestinian demonstrators and removing a protest encampment the Ivy League college had been trying to get rid of for a couple of weeks. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, 20 years ago, as many as 300,000 people were murdered in Darfur. And there are now fears of renewed genocidal slaughter as Al-Fasher, the last city held by Sudan's military in Darfur, is surrounded by the Rapid Support Forces, a powerful paramilitary group. The US envoy to the United Nations says the city is on the precipice of a large-scale massacre. Well, I'm joined now from Brussels by the Sudanese-Australian writer and broadcaster Yasmin Abdel-Majid. Yasmin, many thanks for joining us. I know we spoke on Saturday. I wonder if you could tell us what's happening on the ground.
Thanks, Georgina. So the situation, as we've heard, is quite dangerous. And there have been all sorts of alarms, five kind of level fire alarms being rung because the scale is catastrophic. So what we're looking at is the last city in Darfur that has not been under RSF or the paramilitary control has been this kind of safe space where hundreds of thousands of Darfuris from around the region have come as a safe haven, because at the beginning of the war, which kicked off in April last year, the local leaders were able to set up a truce. So all of the violence that had been inflicted across the rest of Darfur, which included a massacre in Jenina, which is another town in the west, which is reported to have seen between 10 to 15,000 killed, that sort of violence, El-Fasher escaped because of this local truce. Now what is happening is that truce has started to break down, and it's looking like all the concern is the kind of violence that we've seen across the rest of the region, the kind of violence that we saw 20 years ago will be visited on El-Fasher. Part of the reason, just really what I would say is part of the reason this truce has fallen apart is because the armed forces, the Sudanese armed forces, the SAF, have either persuaded or induced rebel groups to join them or to say that they will work alongside the Sudanese armed forces. And so now you've kind of got a splintering of the power base that was.
So control of Al-Fasher would give the group a block of territory that, combined with neighbouring areas, covers about one third of Sudan. How would that change the face of the war, which, as you say, has been raging for over a year now?
This is exactly right, Georgina. And this is one of the concerning, the sort of broader concerning parts. Yes, the immediate risk of large-scale massacre, but also the fact that a third of the country would be under RSF control. And what we know is that the Sudanese armed forces is much more interested in Khartoum, which is in the center, and kind of below Khartoum, an area that has that is sort of agricultural and so on. And there's a real risk that what we'll see is a splintering of the country such that the Sudanese armed forces will hold and is more focused on, on the sort of the east and the south, and the RSF will control the west. And so there won't necessarily be one, something like what we've seen in Libya or other places in the region, where you have completely different and opposing armed forces managing different parts of the country. This, of course, would be a disaster scenario because the RSF is not a governing body. Yes, the Sudanese armed forces themselves are not necessarily the ideal scenario either, but the RSF are a militia. They are not designed or set up to do any governance. And what you would find, what you'd end up with, is a sort of long, chronic battle where the nation and the civilians, like, people are describing this as a civil war, but it's actually a war against civilians. And if the RSF is able to capture this much land, it'll be much more difficult to get back to a united nation and a single governing body.
Mm. What foreign support does the RSF get, and what pressure has been brought to bear on those foreign backers?
It's been quite interesting over the last few days because it's generally understood that the United Arab Emirates is the main supporter of the RSF. There's been a UN report that was seen by a number of news organizations around the world that sort of confirms this, and it's been what analysts and experts have said for some time. However, the UAE has strongly denied any financial or military support to the RSF, even moving to most, I think in the last day or so, cancelling meetings with British officials because they are so angry at the fact that British officials are saying to the UAE that they need to stop supporting the RSF. So it's quite interesting that that this kind of is happening. And on the other side, you also have Russia playing a little bit more of a role. Now, usually people ask about Russia and I say the Russian interest is not as significant as we'd like to think. But on Monday, the Russian deputy foreign minister visited Sudan in a signal of support for the Sudanese army because they are interested in, a port on the Red Sea and so on. And so you are starting to see more and more sort of obvious intervention from people like Russia. And even though the UAE will deny it, it is very, very clear that they are supporting the RSF. So it is more than just the people on the ground. It is all of the foreign interests as well.
Mm. Now, even if the attack on Al-Fasher is thwarted, Sudan, one of Africa's largest countries, has been absolutely devastated. I mean, UN officials say it's a vast humanitarian crisis, one of the biggest in decades. Can you tell us more about that aspect of the problem?
This is a generationally catastrophic crisis. The UN reports that 25 million, about half of the population, is in need of humanitarian aid. It is the largest displacement crisis. So between 8 to 10 million people have been displaced. Around 2 million have left the country, but massive movement of people. You've got around 19 million children who haven't been in school for a year, got mass malnutrition. And also, I mean, Sudan is a country that is very rich in agriculture, but what we're seeing is because of the conflict, the harvest season is being missed. And so you're not getting the opportunity for people to be able to feed themselves, the subsistence farmers and so on. And so you're going to have another wave of catastrophic hunger. It has the big F word, famine, is on the horizon. And but that is very, once you sort of get to that point, it's very difficult to pull it back. And also, as we know, the impacts are generational. Moreover, you've got about 70% plus of the hospitals out of service, massive infrastructure destruction. Many parts of the country still don't have electricity. Telecommunications is out. My own family, for example, we hear from them once every week or so when they're able to access a Starlink, which is Elon Musk's kind of like satellite. People, the sort of Starlink terminals are on the black market in Sudan, and people kind of buy minutes here and there to be able to tell people around the world that they are safe and alive. Mm. And so you've seen this massive destruction of infrastructure across the country, especially in Khartoum, which is the capital city. And when we're thinking about rebuilding, I mean, if, you know, the guns stop tomorrow, the scale of rebuilding, the amount of investment that would be required, and the amount of time it will take. I mean, I think although we've sort of been focused on the war, the tragedy is that this is something that will take many, many years. That being said, and I want to sort of add a hopeful note, is what we've also seen is the people on the ground, the emergency response rooms and the resistance committees, who are the sort of the groups that allowed or fought for, non-violently fought for the revolution in 2018, 2019, they've effectively been running a completely independent welfare state on the ground. So you've got all of these groups across the country who have, through grassroots effort, been feeding tens of thousands of people, been setting up, you know, small types of schools and education centers, been performing, you know, medical support and so on. And so I think, and this is the real hope and the real push that many, many Sudanese observers and analysts consistently bring up, is if we are able to empower these emergency response rooms rather than going and focusing kind of at the military level, expecting the military and the militia to be able to govern, if we're able to find a way to empower those on the ground who are kind of doing this governing anyway, then you can, when you come to rebuild, you're actually rebuilding in a sustainable manner.
Yasmin, thank you very much indeed. That's Yasmin Abdel-Majid there. And this is The Globalist. It is 2012 in Honolulu, 712 here in London. Earlier this month, the US, Japan, Australia and the Philippines carried out their first full-scale joint naval exercise in the South China Sea. And tomorrow, the defence ministers of the four countries will meet in Hawaii to consider collective capacity. Well, I'm joined now by Alessia Petalana, who's a professor at King's College London and an expert on Asian defence. Alessia, many thanks for coming back on the programme. What is collective capacity?
Good morning, Georgina. That's an excellent question. I think collective capacity should be understood certainly the one level as the capacity to project a sense of unity, a sense of political dislike for how China is managing its differences of opinions, its competing claims with the Philippines in particular. It's about making a statement in terms of the cohesion that exists, in this case around the Philippines, when it comes to what the Japanese call consistently a free and open Indo-Pacific that is based on rule of law and in which the use of coercion and coercive measures to conduct a difference of opinions and regards to, in this case, claims in the South China Sea are not the rule, do not become the main preferred currency for interaction. So I think in that sense, the most important statement about this idea of a collected sense of behavior is very much about the political and the statement and the symbolism of we stand for the rule of law and a certain type of behavior.
And how key is the Philippines to this group?
I mean, this group is getting together in this particular sort of context precisely because of the Philippines. So the Philippines are in many ways in the driving seat or of creating the opportunity for an endeavor that the United States has been sort of guiding and crawling together. I think what is also important is that we've noticed last month with a visit of Prime Minister Kishida in DC that at the heart of this project of a stronger collective pushback on China and Chinese behavior. The Japanese have been working very closely with the United States and also converging with Australia. So the three countries together who are very concerned with the problem of stability in the region, I think see this collective action, at least politically, to give a sense of project a sense a form of, if you want, deterrence to Chinese behavior, to remind China that there is an alternative to its own behavior, and that is when other countries get together. And the Philippines, in particular, because of the number of steps they've recently taken under the new Marcos administration with the United States to reinforce the bilateral ties, they are very much the driving seat of this particular, if you want, quadrilateral convergence.
China analysts are saying, though, that eventually this clique is unsustainable. It's bound to show cracks and divisions, that it will ultimately lead to a deterioration of the Philippines' strategic security environment. Do you think that's the case?
I mean, they would say that, wouldn't they? And in many respects, it reflects, I think, two important aspects. One, a fundamental sense of discomfort in China, because the Chinese don't really have an alternative. You know, if the Chinese wanted to do the same thing, they wouldn't be able to. So the first point to make is that is a reflection. The type of analysis and comments is very much aimed as like, no, this thing is not going to work, in part because it reflects that the fact that they can't really do the same, even if they wanted to, number one. Number two, however, it does have seeds of truth in the sense that exercises are fine. This the sort of like a meeting together of the ministers of defense, also very important to discuss how to bring cooperation forward and the extent to which they want to institutionalize this military cooperation activities. However, it also becomes a bit of put the spotlights in on how you will continue to show progression within this context. So there is the added mild challenge of, okay, now you draw attention to what you're doing. How will you show progress in order to maintain the deterrent element of this statement valid over a longer period of time? So in that sense, I think the Chinese analysts do have a point, because this cannot just be the sort of thing that remain sort of on paper. It needs to show an element of institutionalization of that relationship for the type of intended deterrent element to continue to work.
Now, ministers are also going to attend a change of command ceremony on Friday. So Admiral Samuel Paparo will take over from Admiral John Aquilino as the new head of the US military's Indo-Pacific Command. Now, Paparo has spent nearly 40 years in uniform. He's gone from the cockpit of a fighter jet to boots on the ground in Afghanistan. I wonder how important this position is as head of the Indo-Pacific Command in terms of global security, and how will Paparo approach that role?
So first of all, I've met Samuel Paparo on a couple of occasions. I was at RIMPAC 2022, which in many ways he de facto hosted, the practical level. And he's a very, level-headed type of person. As you said, this is someone that knows the region incredibly well. He is incredibly respected across the region. He attends most of the forum, and he's been sort of in the driving seat with his current position at Pacific Fleet, as the face of the United States, if you want, in the military context across the region. So he's moving up in Indo-Pacific command position is absolutely central to continue to drive a sense of reassurance across the region of what type of military understanding the United States is projecting across the broader Indo-Pacific. But the position itself is a position that has grown within sort of the context of the U.S. military commands. Indo-PACOM has become now a point of reference. And the fact that they're meeting there, well, first of all, why wouldn't you want to meet in Hawaii to begin with? But more importantly, is that Hawaii is almost, if you want, the midpoint, bringing together Japan, the Philippines, the United States, in Australia. So there is a sense that this isn't something that is going to be sorted out in Washington. This is something that you need to address within the region. And Hawaii, therefore, has that added element of symbolism, and which strikes to the importance of Indo-PACOM, the people in it who have the understanding and the practical knowledge of the region, and gives a sense that how the United States and its partners and allies will behave will be very much center in that forward line of positioning right in the middle of the region.
Alessio, thank you very much indeed. That's Alessio Patalano there. Now, still to come on the programme.
We know that people visit, you know, Mallorca, so we don't really have a demand problem. What we want to communicate is, you know, we know that you'll come to Mallorca, but just make sure that when you come, you're more responsible.
We hear about Mallorca's efforts to advocate for sustainable tourism. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me in the studio is Terry Stiastny, the political journalist and author. Good morning to you, Terry.
Good morning.
Let's start with something we're reporting in our headlines, and that's the police in the US going into Columbia University in Manhattan to clear away protesters. Big splashes on, obviously, most of the US papers. Let's have a look at what the New York Times says.
Yes, the New York Times has been reporting the updates on this overnight in New York, and there's some fairly dramatic images here, particularly you can see this is Hamilton Hall, where the protesters have been occupying it, and the police have got almost a sort of a van with a kind of a ladder up to it, and lines and lines of New York police officers going not in through the doors but up in through a sort of first or second floor window to try and get into the university. They're there in riot gear, and there have been quite a number of arrests, and also quite a bit of criticism of, you know, the way that this has been handled. You know, as you know, obviously a big argument going on between whether this is right for students to be able to protest, whether it is them just expressing their freedom of speech, or whether these are now disruptive protests, and whether, you know, the police and the university authorities were right to crack down on this. And this seems to be now something that has been happening also across the country as well, and in several other universities where there have been occupations, the police also seem to be going in.
Mm. Now, one interesting aspect is that amongst those pushing the university to crack down on pro-Palestinian demonstrators was a group of 21 House Democrats, and that meant that, in fact, there is bipartisan support for this.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, obviously, there's been this political argument about it. You know, the president of Columbia University threatened that the Democrats were urging the board of the university to either act decisively or to resign. And these Democrats have written a letter in which they say the time for negotiation is over, the time for action is now, and they're saying that the trustees of the university ought to either, you know, do something about it, or they should resign and be replaced by other people.
Which, of course, we've seen happening in other universities. I mean, the thing is that end of term is, what, in a couple of weeks' time? Had they just sat tight, would this not have played out?
Well, again, I mean, I think this has been just such a difficult balance to hold for the universities. I mean, the president of Columbia, Manu Shafiq, has been saying that, you know, she had the support of the trustees. But I think also there was a feeling, many people felt that some students couldn't, particularly Jewish students, couldn't feel safe in the university. And I think, you know, the difficulty here for the university authorities is, when does a protest stop being just a protest about people expressing their political views? And when does it become something that is disruptive to the university running more generally, and also potentially threatening to students and other people?
And what good can it ultimately do? I mean, if we look back in history, 1968, with the Vietnam protests at Columbia and other universities, I mean, did have an effect.
Yes, I mean, and I think this was, you know, this certainly seems to have been something that was kind of spreading nationally throughout the states. And obviously, I think, you know, the more you crack down on people and ask them to stop protesting, often the more people feel absolutely justified and thinking, well, you know, if everybody is against us, then we must be in the right. And that, so, you know, it kind of strengthens the protesters' resolve sometimes.
Well, one person that was there and participating in those 1968 protests at Columbia was the American author Paul Auster, who's died at the age of 77. Lots and lots of obits about this really quite complicated man.
Yes, I think, you know, I think this was a sort of synchronicity that he would have kind of approved of, and something you could imagine being in a Paul Auster novel, because they were so often about chance and about strange things happening. And if you read particularly his obituary in the New York Times, it talks about how one of the things that was his, you know, real sort of, not quite an origin story, I suppose, but one of the things that he talked about was the role of the chance played. And that, you know, when he was himself, he was 14 years old, and he saw a boy who was standing near him be struck by lightning. And ever after that, started to think about, you know, why was it that boy who was hit and not me? And sort of the different things that could happen in potential different timelines. And I think, you know, one of the things I really loved about Paul Auster is that he was experimental. And it's interesting, if you look at the French papers today, a lot of the French sort of literary establishment really, really loved Paul Auster. They had this.
He was huge in France.
Yeah, he was massive. Yeah. He was massive in France. So although he was, you know, a New Yorker born and bred and wrote about New York and often set his books in New York, he had this kind of international appeal. But he took, you know, sort of genre books. Like, if you read the New York trilogy, it's got the form of normal detective story, but it's just strange coincidences and strange things happening and different identities. You know, a writer who writes under a pseudonym being mistaken for somebody else and then setting off on this strange sort of odyssey around New York. So, yeah, yes, it was kind of experimental and different, but he really knew how to tell a story and how to play with the different genres.
Absolutely. Now, the mistake, I'm going to call it, called Brexit, continues to offer up new little gems. Right now, it looks like it could add 60% to costs. That's for importers. It'll undoubtedly be passed down to the consumer. Tell us what this is all about.
Yes. So this is the Guardian is reporting on the first day when Britain has at last finally introduced these post-Brexit checks on, particularly on food imports, things like meat and dairy products, which is something the government's been saying they're going to do for a while. They hadn't done it because it was perceived as potentially causing, you know, even more disruption. So the Guardian has been to see what was actually happening at the ports in Dover. And what they've really found is quite a lot of confusion, because, you know, the government took a long time to say when it was actually going to implement these checks, and nobody, according to the people that they've spoken to at the border, seems to know exactly how much you're going to have to pay if you're an importer, because they're saying you've got to pay for one consignment, and nobody seems to know what that means. Does that mean, you know, one box of something that you've sent? Does that mean a whole container full? Does that mean a lorry load? So obviously a lot of the importers are saying these fees on the produce that they are exporting to Britain are going to cost them huge amounts of money. One producer is saying up to £1,300 a shipment, and they're saying that as a result of this, food prices in the UK will rise even further because those costs are being passed through the supply chains. You know, costs are going up already for all sorts of reasons. And so it's saying that here, a variety of products from different locations, if you've got beef from one place, milk from another place, eggs from somewhere else, there will be multiples of extra costs. And of course, inevitably, you know, that is going to feed through to what the consumer's already paying.
Let's go to your last story, which I absolutely love. It's completely fascinating. It's from The Times and it's about lab mice doing their own experiments.
Yeah, this is also potentially a bit of a Paul Auster sort of story here. The headline in The Times is "Mousetrap: Cunning Lab Rodents Take the Mickey." And the story says that when scientists work with laboratory mice, it's usually assumed that humans are the ones doing the research. A study suggests, however, that the rodents may often be surreptitiously carrying out their own experiments by purposefully making mistakes. And so they've looked at some mice and they've sort of said that, well, if the mice are doing something with a reward. So, for instance, there were thirsty mice and they had to try and turn a wheel and they heard one of two different sounds. And so as a result of that, they got the water that they wanted. So they turned a wheel one way, they turned a wheel the other way. If then they got their drink of water. But after a while, the mice apparently got bored of doing this. So they just kind of went, no, I'm just going to keep turning the wheel to the left, or I'm going to keep turning the wheel to the right. And even if I don't get my drink of water, this is more fun. And so one of the researchers said he believed that the mice knew all along what they were meant to be doing, and it seemed unlikely they were making simple mistakes. He suggested they were purposefully forsaking the reward and were instead conducting experiments of their own.
Which is quite extraordinary.
So perhaps the mice are actually experimenting on the researchers. Who have we thought of this? Perhaps they, you know, seeing how do they behave if we keep turning the wheel? Will they get cross? You know,
as you say, a story worthy of Auster. Terry Stiassny, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The United Nations has warned that an Israeli assault on Rafah in the Gaza Strip is on the immediate horizon, and that incremental progress by Israel on aid access to the enclave cannot be used to prepare for or justify an operation. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed for states with influence over Israel to do everything in their power to prevent an Israeli assault on Rafah in southern Gaza, where more than 1.2 million displaced Gazan Palestinians are sheltering. China launched sea trials for the Fujian, its third and most advanced aircraft carrier, state media reported today. The development of the Fujian is part of a build-up central to President Xi Jinping's bid to make China the preeminent military power in the region, with a blue water navy capable of projecting power far from China's coast. And New York City police raided Columbia University late on Tuesday to arrest dozens of pro-Palestinian demonstrators, some of whom had seized an academic building, and to remove a protest encampment the Ivy League college had sought to dismantle for nearly 2 weeks. Footage shows throngs of helmeted police marching onto the elite campus in Upper Manhattan, a focal point of student rallies that have spread to dozens of universities across the US in recent days, expressing opposition to Israel's war in Gaza. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, says that the European Union must get bigger or risk facing a new Iron Curtain along its eastern flank. There are currently 9 countries from Eastern Europe and the Western Balkans waiting to become fully fledged members of the EU. And these countries face political and ideological attempts by the Kremlin to occupy them, Michel said. Well, joining me in the studio is Nina Dos Santos, who's an international broadcast correspondent and the former CNN Europe editor. Good morning to you, Nina.
Good morning.
Michel was speaking on Monday as the bloc marked 20 years since its largest ever enlargement, and he made reference to 2004 when 10 countries, including 7 former Soviet republics or satellite states, were granted EU membership. I wonder how and why this de facto expansion was so important to the then development of Europe.
Well, I remember covering this 20 years ago, back in 2004, when we saw all of these countries that were, you know, as you were saying before, behind the Iron Curtain, integrated into the EU. There's a lot of scepticism, by the way, particularly from countries like the UK, France, you know, more traditional, original EU members, that these countries could be integrated. And they've been a huge success. Take a look at, for instance, Poland. You know, yes, they've had their issues, not seeing eye to eye with previous governments with Brussels, particularly on things like the rule of law. But the real concern here is whether or not the EU continues to expand to, as you were saying, push back a sort of belligerence of Russia that could if it wanted to, use sympathies in certain mini states inside these troubled Balkan regions. I'm thinking most in particular about the Republika Srpska, which is a pro-Serb state inside Bosnia-Herzegovina. But also, remember that the EU has extended the possibility of membership to Moldova, that has its own potential breakaway region of Transnistria, which has pro-Kremlin sympathies. So Charles Michel here, you know, reinvigorating this concern about Russia and, by the way, also China getting a foothold here to try and cleave these remember, these are also war-torn countries that 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago had their own really bloody civil wars, that they could cleave them away from Brussels because, essentially, Brussels has promised them membership for so long and done not a huge amount about it. Although Charles Michel, a few months ago, did suggest that 2030 could be a date for these countries to join. Not all that many of them believe the EU on that, though, it has to be said. Mm.
So what's the downside? I mean, could Europe be storing up trouble for itself by granting these countries membership? What about the cost of enlargement?
Yeah, this is the crucial thing. So on the one hand, you've also got the EU trying to signal to Ukraine that it can become a member of an expedited potential member of the EU, you know, if and when in the near term the war eventually dies down. And the problem for some of these countries is essentially that some people view them not necessarily as democratic as other EU states. They've been backsliding on things like, you know, reforms. They have to reform things like the, you know, issues to tackle corruption, media freedoms, adhere to certain stringent criteria on the rule of law. They have to create a market economy. But they might argue, well, you know, there's some countries like Hungary, for instance, that have backslided on these issues. Some Western EU states will say, look, these aren't entirely democracies. Some of them might be stabilitocracies, if you like, you know, with some autocratic tendencies and leaders that are backed up by, say, the United States. As I was saying before, they've borrowed money and been a foothold for the Belt and Road Initiative from China. And so not everybody inside the EU will be as keen to welcome absolutely everyone on the same path. But there is a growing sentiment inside the European Commission that, you know, it's a moment of now or never. These countries need, you know, either to be inside the EU or inside the EU's orbit. Lots of them, by the way, remember, are part of NATO. And you'll also remember that, you know, Russia also had that putsch back in Montenegro a few years ago when it became eventually successfully a member of NATO, but there was almost a coup that appeared to have been engineered by the Kremlin back then. So they don't want any more of that type of activity. Ursula von der Leyen, at the helm of the EU Commission, says, you know, once they get past these European parliamentary elections, this should be an absolute priority. But the question is whether or not 2030 is too soon for some of these members or too far away for others.
And of course, in July, Hungary holds the six-month rotating presidency of the Council of the EU. We know that Viktor Orban threatened to single-handedly halt the opening of accession talks with Ukraine. He was going to use his veto power. And I wonder if the Hungarian presidency, combined with what's probably going to be a much more polarised European Parliament post those elections, will further delay candidate countries' paths to membership.
I think that's an excellent observation, Georgina. You know, obviously we know that the centre-right is going to be in the ascendant in these European parliamentary elections, and its only real threat materially comes from the further right, including people like Viktor Orban's party. And as you were pointing out before, they're going to have the six-month rotating presidency of the EU, which means that when it comes to those EU Council decisions, remember the comments you initially referred to from Charles Michel, he is at the helm of the EU Council. That's at the leader rubber stamp level of those three institutions inside the EU. That will be crucial as to whether or not they will rubber stamp the paperwork to keep these countries on track. It's a question of whether or not they can keep them on board, keep them motivated to join the EU. You know, many of them, like Albania, are not far from Turkey, that for years and years was promised the opportunity to join the EU and now has completely disassociated itself from any wish, perhaps, to join the EU. So there is some scepticism as well. And remember that there's, again, still question marks over issues like Kosovo. Not all EU member states themselves actually recognise Kosovo.
Nina, thank you very much indeed. That's Nina Dos Santos there, and you're with Monocle Radio. It is 10:38 in Tbilisi. That's 8:38 in Zurich. Now, last night, police in Tbilisi reacted with tear gas and stun guns in a violent crackdown on demonstrators who oppose a bill on foreign agents, which has been described as authoritarian and Russian-inspired by Georgia's opposition and Western countries. The bill would require organisations receiving more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. It's heightened divisions in the deeply polarised Southern Caucasus country, setting the ruling Georgian Dream Party against a protest movement backed by opposition groups, civil society, celebrities and the president. Well, the journalist Joshua Kuchera, who's based in Tbilisi, joins me now. Joshua, many thanks for coming on the show. Can you tell me what happened last night and the events on Saturday and on Sunday and Monday leading up to this crackdown, the competing rallies?
So last night was the biggest opposition rally that we've seen so far. This was all set in motion by about a month ago, the government, the ruling party, reintroducing this law on foreign agents, that they tried to introduce last year and failed. Large protests last year forced them to back down. Now, for unclear reasons, they've done it again. And what we've seen is a kind of steadily escalating movement of protests, just as we did last year, incidentally. The opposition protests have been growing, and then on Monday they had the ruling party itself had a kind of pro-government rally, a pro-law and foreign agents rally, which was quite large but quite apathetic. They bust in a lot of people, and then last night was the largest one yet. And the first one to turn really violent. Police used water cannons, tear gas. I wasn't there myself, but I've talked to people this morning who were, and they say that the police action was pretty unprovoked. You see video that was quite violent actions. People were beaten very badly. And so we're in kind of uncharted territory right now. The bill is in its second reading in Parliament today. The protesters and the ruling party both seem to be kind of willing to go all in on this. So it's kind of treacherous territory.
Are the protesters back on the street outside Parliament?
Not yet right now. I think it's still too early. I mean, things went on till 3, 4, 5 in the morning last night. So I think people are taking a break at the moment, but I'm sure they'll be back tonight.
Now, as you said, the Georgian Dream Party introduced the legislation last year. It was forced to withdraw it following protests. It brought it back with very minor wording changes. Do you think that we could see a similar outcome where they will back down in the face of this huge protest movement?
I mean, it's very hard to imagine them backing down a second time. It would be a huge kind of debacle for them. I mean, it would be a huge show of weakness for them. And so I think that they're going to have to pass the law one way or another over these protests. But then what happens aside that? That's the big question that nobody knows.
So we know that last week, 100 local civil society organizations and media outlets issued this joint statement saying that they're suspending cooperation with the government until it drops the bill. It was a very powerful statement. How much influence do they actually have, though?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, these are, of course, the groups that are being precisely targeted by this law. I don't know that they have a lot of kind of public influence. They have a lot of influence over the discourse, over the media, over the way that things are talked about here. I mean, I'm not sure, though, that they're going to really rally people to the streets. I think what people are afraid of is the negative statements from the EU, the idea that this law is a quote-unquote Russian law. Has been a powerful kind of brand of the law, and people see the protesters out on the street see this as a kind of geopolitical turning point. Rightly or not, this is what they see is happening, and they're out there to fight for kind of their European future as they see it.
I mean, is there also a worry that the EU will rescind the fact that Georgia's a candidate for membership?
I can't imagine that they would rescind it. I'm not an EU expert, but I mean, they haven't rescinded Turkey's candidacy. So it seems like the bigger worry is that it would just stagnate, and that, you know, the next step for them is supposed to be accession talks. And now the question is whether they will start these accession talks and whether this will kind of disqualify them for that next step.
Yeah. I wonder what role the president, Salome Zurabishvili, has, how much power she has in this. She's distanced herself from the policies of the ruling party. She says she'll veto the bill if it's formally adopted in a third reading. Does she have any power?
Not formal power. I mean, she's kind of a figurehead and she does have this veto, but the parliament has enough votes to override the veto. So she's vetoed plenty of things that they've done in the past and they always override it. But it will be another, yet another occasion for a protest. The protesters have timed these things at moments when the parliament is taking action on the bill. That's why the big protest last night, because they started the second reading yesterday. But she has a kind of, she's grown in stature a lot. When she was elected a few years ago, she was widely seen as kind of a Georgian dream puppet. Then over the years, she's quite sharply turned and has become kind of the most prominent Georgian dream opponent, although her formal powers are limited and symbolic.
Parliament didn't vote on the bill last night. So what happens next? Will it go through today?
I believe they're going to resume talks on it, discussions of it at noon in a little more than an hour. So, I mean, I think that it's safe to assume that they'll pass it on the second reading today.
Joshua, thank you very much indeed. That's Joshua Kuchera speaking to us from Tbilisi. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people,
Hi. We
bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk business now with Rachel Papazzoni, a national business reporter and presenter at ABC News in Australia. Welcome, Rachel. Let's talk about the US Fed concluding its two-day meeting today. What's that going to do?
Yeah, so the expectation is that the Fed will keep the interest rate there on hold, keeping the borrowing rate in its target range of 5.25% to 5.5%. And this, I guess, is a stark change to sort of the conversations that we were all having just a few months ago when we were expecting cuts to start well back in March, and now that's been pushed back to June. And the reason why we're seeing this delay is because inflation continues to be very sticky, particularly services inflation. So that kind of data will go into the decision-making of the US Fed, as well as some numbers that came out yesterday showing that labor costs in the US are continuing to rise up 4.2% year on year. So that's essentially wage pressure. Wages are on the way up and consumer confidence is falling. It's down to its lowest point in about 1.5 years. So markets are lower, were lower on Tuesday's session in anticipation of the outcome of the US Fed. And as I said, we've seen this sort of expectation of cuts really ramp down from what many thought might have been 150 basis points worth of cuts to this year to now about 31 basis points worth of cuts. So we'll get an idea from Jerome Powell when he addresses the media later today, local time, after that US Fed decision, because they'll also reveal their sort of quarterly economic projections as well. So that may give the market a little bit of certainty, as much as it can in this environment, as to what the Fed's next move might be, and indeed when.
And central banks around the world watch what happens in the US as well as their own economic circumstances. And it looks like where you are in Australia, there's been a backflip on rate forecasts.
Much like what we've seen in the US, where that sort of expectation of when a cut might the cutting cycle might start has really been pushed back. And in fact, just in the last couple of days, we're now starting to hear from a number of economists that are actually predicting it might not be a cut that is the next move from the central bank here in Australia, with some going so far as to say that we could expect 2 to 3 rate hikes in throughout this year and into next. And that's also because we're seeing our inflation reading come in much hotter than expected as well. Early indications suggested that inflation was indeed falling. We were getting limited data each month, but the quarterly number showed that that indeed was wrong, and inflation continues to remain much higher than anticipated. And an interesting note that came across my desk today, Georgina, from one economist saying that it's not just our sticky inflation that's leading them to this conclusion of 2 to 3 hikes. It's actually looking at US politics as well. And if Donald Trump is elected and imposes inflationary tariffs, that'll have a global impact and lead our bank to act and push rates higher. So if economists are thinking that might happen here in Australia, I suspect economists globally are thinking that similar for their central banks as well.
Mm. Now let's have a look at Southeast Asia, where Microsoft is expanding as it moves to increase its AI offering. Tell us more.
Yeah, the CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, is in Southeast Asia this week. Recently today, announcing in Thailand that Microsoft will open its first regional data center there. It'll become one of 300 data centers globally, and this is to boost the availability of cloud services and AI technology in Thailand. Just yesterday, he was in Indonesia announcing $1.7 billion worth of investments in artificial intelligence there as well. And this is all part of a program to upskill about 2.5 million people in the region by 2025. So expect to hear more on investment from Microsoft in countries like Thailand, Indonesia, but also Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam. These are, particularly for us in Australia, very important technology hubs. A lot of outsourcing of Australian companies goes to parts of Southeast Asia, and I'm not sure we're not the only country that uses that. So Thailand in particular really wanting to grow its place in that space and become a real digital economy hub.
Rachel, thank you very much indeed. That's Rachel Papazzoni there. And you're listening to The Globalist. With summer around the corner, holidaymakers are counting down the days until they jet off. But in some popular destinations, anti-tourism movements are on the rise. From Amsterdam's campaign against rowdy British tourists to mass protests in Spain's Canary Islands, some residents are pushing back against what they see as the excessive nature of the industry. But how can islands dependent on tourism address the issue without impacting their economies? Majorca's new councillor for tourism, Susanna Schiacovelli, stopped by Midori House to talk about their approach to encourage visitors to vacation responsibly while still having fun. And she began by telling Monocle's Christy O'Grady about the island's tourism pledge.
It's a pledge which has the 8 letters of Majorca, so the M-A-L-L-O-R-C-A. And so each one of the letters has a phrase which is linked to what we want people to know about Majorca. So, for example, the first one is, Majorca is our shared home. Take care of it as it were your own. The phrases are very easy for any child to understand and an adult, because we really think that it has to be simple for everybody to understand. For example, we'll give tips such as, do you know that if you're Majorca and you brush your teeth and you close the tap, you'll be saving 60 liters of water while you're on holiday? So it's very easy tips that we want people to know. The other L is linked to the local product, live and buy local, because in the end, responsible tourism also helps the community. It has to help your local economy. And so if we all want to enjoy the island for the future, we just need to have a lot of fun in Majorca and enjoy our beautiful island. And at the same time, anything that you can do when you're in the island to preserve it is what we want to communicate with this pledge.
And how effective do you think it will be when you have lots of tour groups, coach tours, cruisers, they come out, they take their pictures, they get back on the bus or the ship, and they eat at the places that their tour guides tell them to eat at? So how will you be able to tackle that with your pledge?
everyone can be responsible for Majorca, even if you're coming from a cruise ship. I wouldn't say that that's if you're coming from a cruise ship, you can't be, you know, responsible. And you know, a lot of times we talk about responsible tourism, and I think especially, you know, UK tourists and German tourists a lot of times are very, very conscious with sustainability and responsible tourism. And we don't like to also stigmatize the types of tourism, and we don't like to talk about, you know, quality tourism or not quality tourism. I think all tourists are welcome to Majorca. The important thing is that they receive this message. For us, the novelty is that when you talk about tourist promotion, we know that people visit Majorca, so we don't really have a demand problem. So what we want to communicate is, we know that you'll come to Majorca, but just make sure that when you come, you're more responsible.
And how has the feedback been from residents? Because as you said earlier on, it's really important for people who actually live there to still have the same quality of life while also reaping the benefits of tourism. What have they said about the pledge?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's really important, because you can't just concentrate on the visitors, on the tourists. You need to take care of the residents, and the residents need to feel like they're being visited and not invaded. I think that's a phrase which you've probably heard a lot. And, you know, we live off tourism. So the main economy of Majorca is tourism. The residents that are seeing that this is our new approach are very much appreciating it, because in the end, they are seeing that that's what they also want. When you live in any tourist destination, because I think all destinations that receive a lot of tourists have this issue, but when you see that that tourist is taking care of your island, is bringing, in the end, you know, is taking care of the climate, is coming to a local ceramic place, is buying, is being very respectful, picking up litter if they're there, not throwing litter on the beach and taking care, then you as a resident, of course, appreciate that tourist. The problem is that when you see that the tourist is maybe not doing what they should do, or is littering on the beach, not taking care of the island as they would their own house, that's when you start to say, hey, don't do that with my island. So I think the residents very much, and some, you know, we in Spanish, we call that, we say it's a convivencia, living together and coexistence. And when you reach that, that's when you have responsible tourism, because you actually do have a destination which is beautiful to live in and also to visit.
And one final question about the kind of tourists. Now, you've actually said already that you welcome all sorts of tourists, but not all islands, island nations feel the same. They kind of want to try and restrict the type of tourists that come. A lot of places, like Amsterdam, for example, they want less young male British people going over there for various reasons. Do you want to implement those sort of restrictions or limitations on tourists, or do you think it's more about just educating all people?
The important thing is that we want people to continue coming to Majorca and have fun. What we want to make sure is that they do it responsibly. So, of course, what we are doing is some campaigns where we will say, treat it the same as your own house, and you would not do some kind of things in your house, some kind of behaviors that maybe we don't like when you go to some areas. If you wouldn't do that in your house, why are you doing it in Majorca? So I think that's a question of educating, and you have to do it positively. We are a, you know, beautiful, positive, sunny island. So everything that we do has to be in that linked to something positive. The important thing is also that for whatever reason you're coming to Majorca, whether it's for hiking, cycling, playing golf, gastronomy, culture, just romanticism, party, whatever reason, make sure that you see everything that Majorca has and that you take care of our island. Because I think everybody, residents and tourists, we want to enjoy this island for a lot of years. And so that's our approach to that. So it's not restrictive, it's educating. And then, of course, a lot of things are, we do have different regulations which are there, and these need to be respected. And so we, of course, expect people to respect these regulations, because otherwise, if they don't, then there are consequences. But, you know, we are a tourist promotion board, so we're the ones that need to educate. And that's something I think is the novelty of the Majorca Tourism Board, which is to actually educate in tourism, not to promote Majorca. We know that people love Majorca, and we will, of course, continue to show beautiful videos, but let's take care of it. And hopefully in a few years, we will be associated to responsible tourism. When you think of sustainability of or responsible tourism, I'm sure that you think of mountains in Switzerland, which are green. You don't usually think of Majorca. And I hope that when we think of sustainable destination, we think of Majorca and our beautiful sea.
That was Mallorca's new councillor for tourism, Susanna Schiacovelli, in conversation with Monocle's Christy O'Grady. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Carlotta Ribello and Tom Webb. Our researcher was Gunnar Grunlid and our studio manager, Lily Austin, with editing assistance from Flynn Simmons. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London and The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. In the papers today with Terry Stiastiny, we reported on the death of the US author Paul Auster. Well, he makes it onto the Atlantic's new list of the great American novels, recently published in the magazine. And I spoke to the senior editor, Gal Beckerman, about the books that made the list and why. And you can hear that conversation by heading to our website or wherever you get your podcasts and downloading the latest edition of Meet the Writers. And do let us know if you agree with the list. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.